Hey gang, it's Jesse. I'm just chiming in here to remind you that we're in the midst of our Max Fun Drive. Once a year and only once a year, we come to you hat in hand to ask for your support. 50 weeks out of the year, we pump content into your ear holes absolutely free. 2 weeks out of the year, we ask for money. If you've got a credit card or a bank account or a PayPal account, donating is super easy. All you have to do is go to MaximumFun.org/donate. MaximumFun.org/donate. I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the show, Jim Lara, has been the host of PBS's NewsHour for some 30 years, as well as its executive editor. He's also the author of now 20 novels, the most recent of which is called Super. It's set in the early 1950s on the Super Chief, the legendary streamliner train that ran through America's Midwest and Southwest. It's a sort of murder. I'm going to say murder mystery, possibly a murder death mystery. I don't want to ruin the book for anybody. It's a death. It's an exciting crime or not crime tale. set deep in that world. Mr. Lair, welcome to the Sound of Young America.
Hey, I'm delighted to be here, Jesse. Thank you.
It's an honor to have you. I was interested, most of this book is set in the Kansas bit of the run of this train. I know you're originally from Wichita.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about you were born in the mid 30s, so the Wichita that you grew up in was the tail end and the immediate aftermath of the Depression. What was it like in Wichita when you were, you know, an adolescent, say?
Well, World War II, that was the center of the country, Wichita, and it was the center of the aircraft manufacturing business. The Boeing made the B-17 and the B-29s there, and the Beechcraft had a company, had a factory there. And we thought we were pretty much winning the war. And we woke up every morning thinking the Germans or the Japanese were going to bomb us because we were so important. And but I grew up in the best of every possible world you could have. I had parents who loved me and thought I was terrific. And everything I did, they thought was terrific. I lived in a world where they had good schools, great public schools. In those early years, I was inculcated in, I think DNA is supposed to come first. I was already born before I became a wheel person. I mean, where the moving of wheels meant the moving from place to place, a magic way to go would be on a train or on a bus, whatever. My dad worked for a bus. When I was born, my dad worked for a bus company called Southern Kansas Stage Lines. It was then bought by the Santa Fe Railroad, became the Santa Fe Trailways. And my dad used to say to me, son, there is no more noble work than moving people from place to place for reasons that matter. Well, what would that be? Going away to school? Going to a funeral? Going to war,
something that comes up in the book is memories of troop trains during the war.
Absolutely, and what for me, growing up in those times, because we didn't have the means. Even though Dad worked for a bus company, we had passes. We could go on the buses, but we didn't own a car. And my dad, the Santa Fe Railroad, owned our bus company. And Dad had a pass to go on the Santa Fe Railroad, but he couldn't ride on any of the streamliners. He could only ride on the cheap chair car trains. So for us, seeing one of these Silver Streak streamliners, like the Super Chief, go shoop, you know, through the prairie, it was the place, I'm going to get on there someday. That's the way out. Someday I'm going to go there.
Did you grow up with the idea that you were always going to leave home?
You know, Jesse, I've thought about that a lot, and the simple answer is yes. I knew that what I wanted to do, whatever that was going to be, I was going to have to go away. And one time I wanted to be a baseball player. I wanted to play shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Well, obviously, I was going to have to go to Vero Beach and then to the Brooklyn to do that.
Were you good enough?
No.
I wanted to play third base for the San Francisco Giants, but it was not in the cards.
Well, that's exactly because of that. I had the same problem. I wanted to play shortstop. I wanted to take Pee Wee Reese's place as shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I lived in South Texas, Southeast Texas, a place called Beaumont. And the coach said to me, "You know, Jimmy, you might want to think of something else as a way to go, because you're not a good enough baseball player." But that's what actually turned me on to journalism in a kind of strange way, because I thought, hey, I had met some of these sports writers who came to our games in Beaumont. And I thought, and I liked them, for one thing. They had a kind of thing about them that was mysterious and wonderful and seedy and all that stuff. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I could do that. And I'd go to games all the time. I could write up little stories. And then I had the wonderful experience of having a teacher, an English teacher, who I wrote a paper about something. They called them themes then. And it was a beautiful paper. It was about, I'm speaking very modestly here, but it was about Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. And teacher quite accurately gave me an A. But most importantly, she wrote up in the left-hand corner, Jesse, she said, "Jimmy, you're a very good writer." Well, I told my mother, I went home from school and I told my mother, "I'm going to be a writer." She patted me on the head and said, "That's great, son, go." So I went back to school the next day, found the faculty advisor to the newspaper, and essentially said, "Here I am." And I've been doing it, with the exception of 3 years I was in the Marine Corps. I've been either going to school to learn how to write and be a journalist, or I've been doing it, and I'm still doing it.
I know that you went to junior college, got an associate's degree before you went to 4-year school.
Right.
My mom's a junior college professor. I find that often people who go to JC, it's because they're taking some unusual path. It's rare for someone to go to JC because they're, you know, just doing 2 years here and then 2 years there, and that was the plan all along. What led you? What was your path?
The reason I went to JC my junior college was because we couldn't afford to go to the University of Texas, and I had to go to work. And the junior college in Victoria, for $40, I could go to school the whole year. $40, and I took this job working in a bus depot. Worked 8 hours a day at night, and but I also was editor of the newspaper. Wrote and edited every story that was in the newspaper, wrote the editorials in addition to the news stories, and then took it to the local newspaper, and they printed it. And then I came back to the campus and handed it out to all 320 of my fellow and sister students. So anyhow, it was a marvelous experience, but it never occurred to me that I would not eventually go on to college and finish and get a degree and get a journalism degree and be a writer and be Ernest Hemingway or Ernie Pyle or one of those people. And the H.L. Mencken, for instance, had this library about the size of two bedrooms at this little junior college. And there was a librarian there and said, you want to be a newspaper man, is that right? And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Well, there's a guy named H.L. You ever heard of H.L. Mencken?" I said, no. "Well, look, there's a book down here. You ought to read this. This is a biography of him, and it was written by a guy named William Manchester. William Manchester went on to write many books, including Death of a President." He was the guy who wrote the book about the Kennedy assassination. And I read the book, and this is what I wanted to be. Then I wanted to be H.L. Mencken. But all these things just happened, and I've just been so fortunate each step along the way. When it came time that, okay, now I was going to go to a university and finish and get a journalism degree, I wrote, because I had a typewriter available, I had a typewriter in the office of the bus depot where I was working. I wrote to 37 colleges and universities and asked for their catalogs. Only state universities. There was no no private schools like Harvard or any of that on my horizons. And I decided on the University of Missouri because it had a great journalism reputation, all that. And I wrote a letter and applied at the University of Missouri.
Working in a bus depot while you were still in school, working nights, must have been a great place both to produce an entire newspaper, but also to, you know, a place where your thoughts are on, you know, literal places you can go.
Absolutely. It was the best breeding ground I have ever had for it to be a writer. I mean, I was at behind a ticket counter one night, and I heard a woman scream, and it was a very small waiting room. And I went into the waiting room, and it was a woman's restroom. The woman had slit her wrists. One day, a guy was at the ticket counter. And as he said he wanted a one-way ticket to Houston. I made out the ticket, and just as I put the ticket on the counter, two cops came in and arrested him. This man had just robbed somebody and all this sort of stuff. One time they had the Border Patrol was coming in and rounding up, because this is South Texas, so a lot of brown-skinned people around. And they were being rounded up as illegal immigrants. I had a guy I worked right next to as another ticket agent who was filling in for me and whatever. And he stole money from me. I didn't know that by the way he sold tickets that were he sold them, but it looked like I was the agent, and so he pocketed the money, and then the auditors thought I had stolen the money. And it was, I learned a lot about the, I also learned how to speak into a microphone. You want me to demonstrate that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Please.
All right. It was the first time I was paid money to speak into a microphone. This is Victoria, Texas, halfway between Houston and Corpus Christi. May I have your attention, please? This is your last call for Continental Trailways, 8:10 p.m. Silversides air conditioned through liner to Houston. Now leaving from lane one. For Inez, Edna, Ganeda, Louise, El Campo, Pierce, Wharton, Hungerford, Kendleton, Beasley, Rosenberg, Richmond, Sugarland, Stafford, Missouri City, and Houston. All aboard! Don't forget your baggage, please.
10 stars. That's what I award that
Thank
performance.
You. Thank you.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Jim Lara, the anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour and the author of 20 novels. His most recent is Super. Your first broadcast journalism job was at KERA in Dallas,
That's
if
right.
I'm not mistaken.
That's right, public television station.
How did you end up in public TV rather than commercial TV?
I was a newspaper reporter, newspaper editor. I was city editor of the afternoon newspaper in Dallas, Dallas Times Herald. I'd written a novel. It was made into a movie. We made $45,000 on the movie, which was a lot of money. This is 1959. This was 1969. Sorry, 1969. The book came out in 1966. The movie came out in 69. And my wife, Kate, we had two kids and the third one coming. And Kate said, well, you know, you always said you wanted to write full time. Let's do it. And she was a writer, too. And so I quit to write full-time. And the public television station in Dallas, I'd only been on television one time. That was kind of a local meet-the-press type thing. And they called me and asked me if I would be a consultant to them for news and public affairs, work 2 days a week. They didn't do any programs, so I figured, you know, what the hell have I got to lose? And it was great. And then one thing led to another, and we decided to try an experimental news program, got a Ford Foundation grant. I wrote a proposal. And Fred Friendly, the famed Fred Friendly, who was in with the Ford Foundation, funded us. And suddenly I was on television. And I hired nothing but former newspaper reporters. And did that for two years. And then I was offered an opportunity to go to PBS, to go to Washington. And I never worked in commercial television. I never, ever, in fact, at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, to be on television, I mean, give me a break. I mean, that's not serious. People don't go on television. Serious people write or newspapers and magazines. So I didn't take any courses. I had no longing to do it at all, no desire to do it. But I had the opportunity, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, it was I never turned back, and I have, as I say, I've never worked any other kind of television but public television, and I've been blessed to be with people who shared all my values and all that, my aspirations. Has been terrific.
It must have been exciting to get involved in public television at a time when public television was really figuring out what it was and what it could be.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was kind of created as a result of a meeting. You know, there were some people who thought, well, no, we've got this thing here. It's called educational television. Now, educational television was, you know, television from the classroom, and there was television stations all over the country. Education, because it had been mandated by Congress. And then somebody said, well, let's do more than just that's more than classroom stuff. Well, let's do things for children. And Sesame Street got developed, and they started doing documentaries. And I came the time I came in with KERA and then the PBS. PBS had just been formed, the Public Broadcasting Service, which is everybody calls it a network. It's not a network at all. It's essentially a programming service. It's a cooperative. It's run by all the three or more than 300 public television stations, and it keeps reinventing itself all the time. The purposes kind of remain the same, but there's always been funding problems in public broadcasting, and they're always.
You don't have to tell me. Yeah, we're sitting in my second bedroom.
Have you heard that? Yeah. And so the interesting thing about it, about not having a lot of money to broadcast in a business that requires a lot of money to broadcast, is that you get your priorities straight. Whether you want to, you can't afford to waste any money on something that doesn't matter. And so if you say, well, we could do this little cute story about pineapple sundaes or something like that, or we could probably do something on the fall of the Berlin Wall, maybe send somebody there for an extra day. Well, we do the Berlin stuff because you can't do both. So that really focuses your mind, and it exists to this very day. I mean, public broadcasting right now, the NewsHour, we've been on the air for 35 years. We have financial problems, but we are more vital, more viable, and more innovative now than we were before, because we have to use our money so wisely. We use every little technological thing. You know, you used to spend thousands, millions of dollars on satellite feeds. Well, you can do that now through the internet, but it's very difficult to do, and it takes time. You got to have people, most of them young, who know how to use the technology to our advantage. And it keeps a little bit of hunger is good for people who are trying to do serious business in journalism.
More with the NewsHour's Jim Lehrer after the break. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Hey friends, it's Jesse. You know, this year is the 10th anniversary of The Sound of Young America. 10 years. I can hardly believe it myself. We've been podcasting for more than 5 years now. We started at the end of 2004, if you can believe it. In all those years, we've never charged a penny for the content that we create. Once a year, though, we do ask that you give to support it. It's incredibly easy. Just go to MaximumFun.org/donate and click on the pledge level that you'd like to give. You can give $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. At $100 a month, you become one of Jesse's Golden Eagles. At $200 a month, you're one of Jordan's Platinum Angels. Think about what entertainment you get and what entertainment you value. What things that you listen to or watch are really important? Do you pay for them? Do you watch commercials in your favorite television programs? Do you pay for cable? Did you buy the hardware that you use to watch or listen to your favorite stuff? Producing The Sound of Young America is far from free, and we pay for it thanks to your donations. Listen, even at our highest pledge levels, your monthly donation is relatively small. $20 a month is an amount of money that you will hardly notice as it disappears from your checking account every month. What you will notice is a bunch of great podcasts in your ears every week, be it The Sound of Young America or Jordan Jesse Go or Stop Podcasting Yourself or Coyle and Sharp or the Casper Hauser Comedy Podcast or our blog entries or our videos or our Twitter feeds. All of this is supported by your donations. So if you think what we're doing is important, if you get something out of it, just visit MaximumFun.org/donate right now and follow this simple procedure to give us a little bit. Of course, you'll get something in return. We're always happy to send you thank you gifts, and at every pledge level, you'll get something. But what's important is that every time you listen to this show, you'll know that you're one of the people who's paying for it. Visit MaximumFun.org/donate. And to the hundreds of you who already give, my sincere and heartfelt thanks. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. Super is Jim Lehrer's 20th novel. He's also, of course, the anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour. When you were working with Robert McNeil in the mid-70s, when what is now the NewsHour was just starting out, first as a half hour, then as an hour show, what did you decide or what did he and you decide were the priorities, the things that you were going to put your limited resources towards?
Well, the key to it, and McNeil is the one who used the term, and I agreed with him 100%. We've been very much in sync about it. He said we were going to be known for a place where we would have civil discourse. There would be disagreements, but people would not talk over each other. People would not yell at each other. Not on our air, they wouldn't. We would not do stories that we didn't think mattered. Now, of course, that nickel will get you 4 cents, because what matters to you may not matter to me, you know, so forth. But we would define that as professionals, and people who watched us over a period of time would get our definition of what mattered. It's like any news org, any program or any print medium. You essentially make a contract with your readers or your listeners, and after a while they get used to your judgments. And our judgments would be, in other words, we don't do sports, we don't do weather. Occasionally we do a sports story, but we're not in the sports business, we're not in the weather business. We always try to have at least a quarter of our programming, usually more than that, devoted to international affairs. When McNeil and I started working together, you know, he'd been an international correspondent, a foreign correspondent, he'd been all over the world. I'd been to Nuevo Laredo, is what it boiled down to. And so he brought one perspective, I brought another. But
he was international. He's international. Right. Yeah. He's Canadian, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's Canadian.
We talked about the ways that resources shape priorities. In public radio news, there was always this joke, and maybe it's a little less applicable today, but it was that since there were very few reporters, since NPR maybe had a couple dozen reporters, they would mostly read about something in the newspaper, report it the next day, and call it analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that in a funny way, while NPR now, say, has a few hundred reporters rather than a few dozen reporters, and hundreds more if you count local stations, that perspective has been a strength of the form as those resources have grown rather than a weakness. That idea that maybe timeliness isn't the only essential quality of news. And I wonder what ways you can distinguish your news content that aren't just first and most, the sort of 24-hour cable news cycle. The Onion had an amazing video piece a month or two ago that was some bull happening somewhere. It was a breaking news story, had a profanity in it.
Yeah.
It was nonsensical video, and they were covering it like it was important breaking news. So there's timeliness, and then there's also this kind of intense opiniony stuff to differentiate yourself. But it seems like public broadcasting is uniquely set up to compete and differentiate itself in other areas besides those two.
Well, I agree with you. I think that by the in this new world order that we're in now, if you want to know, did they arrest the suspect in the attempted bombing in at Times Square? There, you can find out in a second. All right, but who was this guy? Well, what do you want to know about him? Was he part of a group? What group? Well, where'd that group come from? And you just keep asking questions. Well, was the law enforcement thing right? What about the why did they? How did this guy get loose to get on an airplane in the first place? And why was he going to Dubai? Well, where's Dubai? What is Dubai? In other words, every step along the way, there's got to be a place that you can continue to go. And public broadcasting, in my opinion, is the place that takes you through those various steps. And we always got to keep in mind that the old way of doing things, which is the first thing you used to be the first time you heard about a story was when you read your newspaper. By the time you read a newspaper now, you know everything. You know what happened long before you ever see that newspaper. So what's the point of the newspaper now? Is to go start peeling it back, keep moving back, moving back, moving back. One of the reasons newspapers are not doing very well because they haven't caught on to that. They haven't trained their folks to move the story with where the curiosity is about the story. And in public broadcasting, the NewsHour, we tried very hard to do that, and sometimes we fail. It doesn't work. We can no longer see ourselves as the first responder journalist. You've got to be that second and third. And you put your finger on it. This is still a development stage for that, and it's got to be compelling. I mean, you got to realize there are all kinds of places you can go second or third time. Second or third step after you find, well, I already know about they arrested the guy. All right, but now who do I want to go take the next step? And you get, I'm not interested in the New York Times. Maybe I'm, you know, but you've got to, it's got to all be there. And those of us who are in this business have to go with the new flow. And public broadcasting should be leading the way. Some ways we are, some ways we're not.
You know, a lot of people who work in public broadcasting and a lot of journalists, and I think quite reasonably, think of what they do, at least in part, in terms of public service, in terms of doing something for others, using what you're good at to help other people, change the world in a positive way, inform people, all of those things. And I wonder whether you evaluated for yourself what portion of your energy you wanted to put towards public service, and what portion of your energy you wanted to put towards, I guess, what you might call private service, mm-hmm. Your responsibilities and contributions to your family, say. And what you wanted to put towards, say, just having a good time being into trains, for example.
Right. Well, you know, it's a great question. I feel very strongly about public service. I also feel very strongly that the purpose of journalism is crucial to the functioning of a democratic society. You don't have I'll quote somebody named Thomas Jefferson who said, "If you don't have an informed electorate, you don't have a democratic society." How do you become an informed electorate? Well, the journalists are the people who do that. I feel very strongly about that, and every day, and I've been doing this for almost 50 years now, daily journalism. I never lose sight of what this is all about. This is not about me. This is not about my becoming a quote TV star. I mean, some people get, the idea you get recognized in a 7-Eleven store and you never quite get over it. And you start waking up in the morning saying, "Good morning, dear. This is your husband with the news," kind of stuff. I've never bought into that because I know what my point is, the point of journalism. And it sounds so, sanctimonious, but so be it. I feel that very, very strongly. But I also feel very strongly that I want to enjoy the things. I want to, because, and the health thing had something to do with that. I don't sing and dance, but if I wanted to, if it made me feel good, I would do it. And I'll do a bus call with a speech or on a radio show. If it makes me feel good, it's fun to do, I'll do it. And I love playing. We have six grandchildren. I love playing with these kids. I love playing catch with them and all that kind of stuff. And it's a mixture. And I think the mixture is what has made me feel so fortunate and has made me so happy. I am the happiest person and the most fortunate person you'll probably ever interview, Jesse, because I have all of these things, all of the above, the things you just asked me about. I have them. I have fun. I am the number one collector of bus depot signs in America. I have 300 porcelain bus depot signs. You know, they hang in, hung in the little small towns. I have 400 bus driver's cap badges. I have 250 or 60 or whatever antique toy buses in my car. I own a bus of my own. A bus that's a 1946 flexible clipper that I completely restored and painted in the colors of my dad's bus company back in the 1940s. These are all toys. I mean, this is all play. This is all, Bernard Malamud, the great writer, told me one time, he said, if you want to write fiction, you better make sure that you never let your mind go above 16 years old, because it's the kids who make up the stories. And writing and making up stories, writing fiction is making up stories. So I am while I'm doing serious business that I think is very, very important. I've moderated all these presidential debates, and I'm very excited. I've got all the scars to prove it, and that's God's work, and that is public service, and I feel good about that. But I also feel good about my little weird things and funny things that I do with my kids and grandkids and with my little bus signs.
It must be nice also to work in your day job towards truth as a journalist and be able to in your night job, while you're in between bus depot calls,
yeah,
to be able to work towards capital T truth in writing fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a big difference. There really is. I mean, you'll never see that. Journalism is not about the truth. Journalism about the facts. I mean, I can say it's a fact. Jimmy Charles Lara said today in Pasadena that the weather was breezy and it was 85 degrees. Or Jimmy Charles Lara could say in Pasadena that it was snowing. The fact is that Jimmy Charles Lara said it, not that it's snowing or, what's beyond that? All right. And in fiction is where you go to the truth. In other words, you go beyond what is just a repertorial statement about what happened. In fiction, you get to why the human spirit causes people to do certain things. What is depression? What is love? What is anger? What is peace of mind? That's where you write about that in fiction. You don't write about that in journalism.
Well, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was great to have you on the show.
I love talking to you, Jesse. Thank you so much.
A sincere honor. Jim Lehrer's new book is super, and it's, we got started talking about really serious stuff, but it's really fun, really great, fun book. I really enjoyed it. Thank you again.
Thank you.
So, did you like the show? If you did, please donate to support. $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Even become one of Jesse's Golden Eagles or Jordan's Platinum Angels at $100 a month or $200 a month. It'll be deducted automatically from your bank account. It's easy. You won't even notice that it's gone. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate right now. I know that your show just ended, so you're not up to anything. Visit MaximumFun.org/donate right now. And of course, we'll thank you with some awesome thank you gifts, and there's all kinds of details about what you can get, including some exclusive t-shirts that you won't get anywhere else. But what's most important is the warm feeling that you'll get in your heart when you listen to one of our shows and you think, oh, I'm one of the people who paid for that. Donate online at MaximumFun.org/donate.